I now call upon the member of opposition, Mr. Bill Hunter.
Members of Parliament, Mr. Speaker, thank you for recognizing me. Members of the panel, thank you. Members of Parliament, thank you all for being here as well, since Jeff and Brian and Brian and I are all never, ever, 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 ever going to win an Academy Award. I also have a long list, thank you. Now, in this Parliament, on videotape, through the latest time, I guess, as well as some people who aren't here right now because they're busy running the tournament and doing some paperwork, there are several people that we have to thank. First of all, Skip, Conrad, and the rest of the Point Loma squad. Thank you for making us feel horribly welcome here. It's been a wonderful tournament. And I'd also like to extend the same thank you to the tournament staff, the executive committee, especially Dr. Trapp. I'm very, very proud to be in the last parliamentary debate round under the Trapp presidency, which has certainly been a fine presidency. But there's also somebody that the previous three speakers have neglected to mention that's helped run the tournament, that's helped run NPDA, that's helped run debate since before my parents were born. And I think you all know who I'm talking about. That's the man who the first speaker award this year is finally being named after and whom it could have been named after 5 years ago, members of Parliament, one Al Johnson, the retired professor from Colorado. Of course, I too must thank my coaches, Marcus Barathi, Robert Margeson, for their help, as well as past coaches, especially Martin Burkholt, without whom I quite literally would not be here and would not even be competing in debate today. Give them a round of applause, please. My teammates, Cheryl, Susan, Christina, Kevin, Nate, who's still a teammate even though he's run out of eligibility, he's kind of hanging around. And also, not only Jeff's family for coming to watch us, but my family for supporting me through videotape, unfortunately, but I'd like to thank them as well for the support they've given me. And Jeff's family certainly have been fine audience members, and I thank them for coming along with us as well. As well as all of our District 9 teams and all of our local friends, and many friends from many states away who've also come to watch us and support us throughout the tournament. Of course, not to neglect our opponents, Ryan Sirik, a new friend, but one of the oldest friends I have on the circuit, a young man who, when I met him in October of 1995, was one of the cockiest people I've ever met in my life. Now that I'm debating him in both of our last parliamentary debate rounds ever, is still one of the cockiest people I've ever met in my life. And who, when at the start of the tournament said see in finals, I thought he was just being cocky, but well, he turned out to be right. As well as my colleague who, well, at times has just lugged me in the backpack and gotten me through more rounds than I can possibly comprehend. I forget who it was, but whenever they called him my better half, they were certainly correct. That in mind, members of Parliament, the substance of today's debate, that housing should be a basic human right, or at least if you buy the rhetoric of the government. Or perhaps not even if you buy the rhetoric of the government, members of Parliament, because keep in mind that the case they offer has about this much to do with housing policy. And you know why? Because it's somewhere in a 5,000-page document that we're going to ratify. Clearly, members of Parliament, the essence of today's debate, the nature of the resolution, was supposed to be at a philosophical, a policy, a value level, whichever level you wanted to pick, whether housing should be a basic right. Now, what the government has done with their case is they've ratified a document which assumes that housing is a basic right. As one of 1,500 basic rights, I don't even know how many basic rights are included in this document. Okay, so, as... You know, Mr. Matthew, that would have been nice and constructive. Yeah. clearly members of Parliament, Jeff and I expected to have a debate about housing policy, housing rights, housing in general, a debate filled with the word housing where finally it got rung into your ears until you couldn't stand to hear it anymore. Guess what, members of Parliament? The members of the government never once in their case talk about why housing is or is not a basic right. They assume it's one of seven we now find out, and they ratify this document, which assumes it, but never do they actually prove the thesis of the resolution. And as far as I'm aware, not only have my fine coaches Marcus Perotsky, Robert Marchison, but even the director of forensics of their squad taught us that the resolution is the thesis to be proven in the round by the members of the government. So because they assume it rather than proving it, you're voting opposition on presumption alone. I'll take the question.
Don't you agree, however, that the government definition is
only if the way the government defines the round properly reflects the intent of the resolution as written, and it clearly does not do so. Now, the members of the government are offering you ratifying housing as one of seven basic human rights. But guess what, members of Parliament? What they're essentially asking you to do is prove the resolution this House would buy a pen by talking you into becoming an Office Max franchisee. And those are clearly different things, members of Parliament. Now, under the criterion, clearly, Jeff and I offer some cost to ratifying this treaty, although Jeff and I contend that there really aren't any benefits because we've got more ink on some paper somewhere and that the world isn't actually going to change in any way, shape, or form. And keep in mind that if there are no costs and no benefits to this policy, you vote with the members of the opposition who get the status quo. That's how presumption works. I'll take another question. Well, I'll be honest, I have the worst memory of everyone I know, so I'm going to have to get to a later page before I can rattle them off. But the one that comes right to mind, members of Parliament, is that we're going to exacerbate the U.S. control of the world in a system which is already dominated by American hegemony, where we already push enough countries around, already tell enough people to enforce their human rights better, and then go against those human rights with our own policy, members of Parliament. Now, I'm not going to accuse the members of the government of thinking to the contrary, but I certainly think that hypocrisy is a clear disadvantage. Not enough time, please. I'd like to get to your contentions, actually. Which brings me to their first contention, that it's immoral of us to sign it. And what's their only justification for it to be immoral for us not to sign it? Well, everyone else has done it. And since my mother is going to eventually see this videotape, I'd like to make an argument now that would make her very proud. I think you all know what I'm talking about, and that's, if all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you do it? Clearly, members of Parliament, no other analysis as to why it's immoral exists. So every other country in the world besides Somalia has done it. Why does that matter? It's never answered by the members of the government. But their second contention is that it harms our international image. And I think it's very important to notice my colleagues' analysis that there are no real negative impacts. Clearly, there are people in the international arena railing against the United States. But what are they railing against? They're railing against our policy in Kosovo. They're railing against our policy in Israel. They're railing against our use of the WTO to twist the borders to free trade open, members of Parliament. They're railing against 15,000 different policies. But as far as I've heard, and keep in mind that I do read the paper so that I can succeed in this activity, not at this time, please. As far as I've heard, members of Parliament, the fact that we haven't signed this document isn't even on the list. In fact, I think empirically, the fact that we tried to twist China's arm and twist Hong Kong's arm and twist all kinds of other countries' arms into complying with our version of human rights through things such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there are probably a lot of countries, in fact, I would even contend the majority of the 120-some-odd member non-aligned movement process in the United Nations, who would be relieved that we're not getting farther into the quagmire of the U.S. telling the rest of the world who has rights, who does not, and what those rights are. keep talking about abortion policy in Ireland, and I don't really know why we do that, members of Parliament. But I think we agree that because Ireland is a sovereign nation, because France is a sovereign nation, because the United States is a sovereign nation, because there are about 190 other sovereign nations in the country, none of it's time for that, and they must move on. We can ask these other nations to, as sovereign nations, determine their own human rights policies. And if they want to sign on to this human rights document, that's fine. But why we, as a sovereign nation, need to impinge upon other sovereign nations' definitions of human rights is never justified in the government case. Now we go to the third area of contention. I think it's very important to notice here that they claim to fix the world. Not solve for everything, of course, but they claim to make the world better. They claim to solve for these problems of the lack of human rights being respected. But keep in mind that their own analysis says that every country but the United States and Somalia has already signed this treaty. Has the world gotten better, members of Parliament? Has every children got a house? Has every children got food on the table? Clearly, if every other country in the world has already signed this document, why all 191 of them out of 193 can't take care of it themselves without the United States' help is never provided. Clearly, if it's going to get better through this document, these other countries have already done it. And if the United States has to recognize basic human rights, well, my colleague's analysis that we already do that, and we already do provide housing for all children through our adoption system and through our foster home system, never really goes into, okay, the adoption of foster homes is new in my case, but the analysis that the United States already does enough to protect human rights of children is never contested by the members of the government. So the rest of the world has signed it, and all benefits you can get there is already taken care of. The United States doesn't need to sign it, so there's no reason to propose. For that reason, for the second time, we beg to oppose.
To close the opposition speech, the actual leader of the opposition, Jed Brodak.
Thank you, of course, one final time to our distinguished members of the panel, Speaker, for his recognition, and everyone in the gallery, in the aisle, and probably everyone else we've ever met that's influenced our life in the debate tonight. Members of this House, I think quite clearly there are three reasons you are siding with the opposition when we're discussing whether or not housing should be a basic human right. Now, the first reason you're going to side with the members of the opposition is because the government doesn't ever debate housing. Now, they say we need to have United States legitimacy. They say we need to be in on Security Council debates. They need to say we need to be able to read a Russian report. And we need to be able to tell Ireland about what type of abortion policy it needs to have internationally. But what we don't ever hear is a discussion about why housing is justified as a basic human right. Now, this line of argumentation is something I spent a lot of time developing in my first constructive. And it was the idea that says the debate shouldn't be about whether we should have all these other bundles of rights, because that's not germane to the resolution, but rather we should discuss if within the document, these children's rights, we should be talking about housing policy. And that clear delineation, when I discussed it with you earlier, has never really actually been responded to. Brian just says, well, it's in the document, therefore we got to talk about the whole thing. But I think my argumentation, Mr. Furman's argumentation, adequately said the debate should be about why housing is a basic human right. And through two constructives from the members of the government, they have given you no analysis as to why housing should be a basic human right, other than there's a document out there. So that brings us to the second reason you should oppose, and that there are no benefits to siding with the members of the government. Now, Brian says in the last 5 seconds of his speech in the response to one of my arguments was that, well, no one's ever going to build any houses anyway because we're just going to say, you know, it should be important. Well, at that point, siding with the members of the government don't really get you anything if you want to believe Brian's analysis. But furthermore, the Prime Minister himself grants to us that at least in the United States, where he says, we don't recognize child housing as a basic human right, we don't have a problem with child housing in the United States. And then finally, you realize that there is no analysis that is shown to why the United States, not being part of the international community, at least on housing policy, prevents any other nation from doing anything to improve child housing. Now, this is important, at least in terms of the United States, because if they don't get you any benefits, they say, well, we're not going to build any houses, and we're not going to really help any children, we're just going to read Russian reports and verify it through the CIA. There is no reason, there are no benefits to siding with the members of the government, and that's their own argument, is that the benefits should outweigh the cost. But there are no benefits, and that brings us to the third reason we'll pose, is that the cost clearly outweighs. Now, my first argumentation that I brought up to you was explaining that at a philosophical level, when we say housing becomes a basic human right, it actually does place that positive obligations on government to actually do a lot of things. Now, Brian just says, well, it won't happen. But we're contending to, at least from a philosophical level, once you take on that role and say, yep, I guess we do have that basic human right, it will trade off with other, more primary services, and as a result, we're not helping children out anymore, we're not helping out other human rights, but we're actually decreasing them overall. And Brian never addresses this position. But furthermore, we tell you, at least at a moral level, we shouldn't use this document to exploit other countries or tell them what to do or force them to do it. Now, Brian says, well, we've done it in the past and we've forced them to do a whole lot of other things, so we should be able to force them to do that too. Members of Parliament, that's not an idea I think the United States should support as being a member of the international community. Quite clearly, housing for children may be important, but when it goes to a point of being a basic human right internationally, the benefits do not outweigh the cost. For the final time, I urge you to oppose.
One Academy Award joke and everybody used it. Okay, that's all right. I'm not going to do any more thank yous because everybody's been so thoroughly thanked, but one more time, thank everyone who's ever been thanked ever before in history, and of course, the members of the opposition for an excellent debate today. Before I do anything else, as we're getting started, before we get to any other additional lines of analysis, the first thing we need to examine is the thoroughly pulse-pounding idea of the resolutional issue. The first thing we need to understand is this. It's a very simple concept. Our job here was what Mr. Matthew told you, to affirm the concept, the very notion, the very statement that housing is a basic human right. Wherein this policy has it written that housing is a basic human right, we are affirming the resolution. It is not any more difficult than that. What I present to you is a very simple concept, and please do not take this in any glib sort of fashion. Just because we did not present the case that the oppositional team wanted to debate does not mean that we are not resolutional in form. Because the words exist, there is no better way to affirm this resolution than signing a document which has those words written explicitly in it. It is the clearest way to sign and to affirm this resolution. And, you know, the idea has been presented that because other things are involved, the resolution becomes secondary. Because other things are involved, it makes for a better debate. It doesn't necessarily mean that these things are excluded from the resolution. What we're trying to say here is simple. The link is very clear, and as both sides have had ample ground to debate, it becomes completely irrelevant. We need to look to only one simple fact. We are affirming the concept that housing is a basic human right, and in doing so, because we accord these other benefits, the opposition has absolutely no ground resolutionally to stand on. We then move into the concept as it was, basically the problem that it was brought before us. But before I even get into that, I'd also like to extend one simple concept through. The oppositional team argued that if we did not debate the resolutional issue as it was presented, the way we should have debated it was in this off-case analysis that was provided just recently, or by Mr. Herman in the very first speech. The idea that the lines of analysis that were presented were judged by him to be the crux of the debate, shelter and not housing, all these things like that. Mr. Matthew made a plethora of responses, his favorite word, and was never refuted in any of them. If this is the crux of the debate, I urge you to pull through all of Mr. Matthew's analysis as to and refutations as to all of the things that they maybe said was the crux of the debate, and in that case, because they never responded to those arguments,
flew in there, too. Moving then into the cases that was presented. Quite simply, we have a problem that is presented before us. What we need to do, in addition to ratifying this concept that that housing is a basic human right, it necessitates that we look to a document which does so. This document being the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Child. What we see then is because we have not ratified it right now, we see that it is looked upon as an illegitimate sort of document. Now, what is the cost that the oppositional team brings to you as the problem? The only cost that is outlined as the only possible problem with signing this document, that we will somehow be espousing our morals, which other countries have read, signed, and agreed to. If the only cost that the oppositional team brings to you is the idea that we are somehow exporting ideals, it is ideals which other countries hold dear as well, and in echoing this and in signing this, we become a more responsible and legitimate society. It's just that simple. Also, we need to look to the idea, when it comes down to cost-benefit analysis then, that we have no cost with which to be weighed against, and since we are resolutional in that we are affirming the concept of housing as a need as it is outlined specifically in this document, we then see the benefits that are incurred by actually signing this policy. Well, first, it increases the legitimacy. I don't care how you slice it. We worked so hard to prepare this document and then didn't sign it. That's illegitimate. By signing it, it makes us look like we're holding good to our word. And that is the most legitimate thing to be considered when you're talking about documents such as this. Now, the opposition presents a great argument. If all your friends jumped off the cliff, would you? I don't think this is a very good analysis for one very simple reason. Nobody's jumping off a cliff. They're protecting other people. It's not a situation where anybody's doing anything that will harm someone or will harm another person. They're protecting them. And you better believe if every one of my friends did something to protect somebody else, I'd be right there behind them helping. Also, I urge you to understand that this team will increase social awareness, a point never addressed by the oppositional team. And in addition to that, we see a number of other benefits that are accrued, and I'm not going to spend all my time rattling off them for you. But first, we need to realize that we do have a method then to actually sit into the council, to actually sit there and actually deliberate with some of these people and have a say in what goes on, and extend our technological advances to validate the report about the rights of children, something that also went unaddressed. In addition, we see, it's very simple. With all these benefits, such as the increased situation of the illegitimacy and the increased amount of solvency that we have, we see no cost for this proposal and beg for a governmental balance.
Colorado State University for an excellent final round debate. I'm now going to escort the judges out back to the room to make their decisions, and the award ceremony begins just momentarily right now.
In Creighton University and Colorado State University was, oh, by the way, they get the big stuff. Should we say second place? In second place was Creighton University, Ryan Sirik and Brian Matthew.
National champions, directed by Robert Morganson, from Colorado State University, Jeff Brodak, Bill Frank.